I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Remember when President Bush said a few bad apples were responsible for hooding and leashing, humiliating naked prisoners at Abu Ghraib in Iraq? In a hearing today, Senate Armed Services Committee Chair Carl Levin said a new report shows that Abu Ghraib was tied directly to top officials in the Bush administration acting over the objections of military lawyers.
The truth is that senior officials in the U.S. government sought information on aggressive techniques, twisted the law to create the appearance of their legality, and authorized their use against detainees. In the process, they damaged our ability to collect intelligence that could save lives.
Well, former military lawyer and Republican Lindsey Graham acknowledged that legal advice the Bush administration received on detainee treatment would, quote, go down in history as some of the most irresponsible and short-sighted legal analysis ever provided to our nation's military and intelligence communities. But he said,
so respectfully, Mr. Chairman, we're not breaking new ground here. The abuses, the inconsistencies, the poor judgment in these matters are well documented. The fact is that we have come a long way in the past 5 years. Secretary Rumsfeld is gone. Wolfowitz, Cambone, and Feith are all gone. John Yoo and Jim Haynes are gone.
That being former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, Douglas Feith, Paul Wolfowitz, architects of the war, John Yoo and Jim Haynes, legal advisors, all that have left the Bush administration. Well, joining us from outside the hearing room is Dimitri Sevastopoulou, Pentagon correspondent for the Financial Times. And Dimitri, we know, you know, not everyone has testified, but the hearing in general is about harsh treatment of detainees. And in the past, Pentagon lawyer Jim Haynes has said that at Guantanamo, it was the military commanders who asked for harsher techniques. Now it sounds as if Carl Levin is saying it was the other way around. It was the Bush administration that went to commanders and asked for harsh techniques.
That's right, Robin. In some ways, there was probably a parallel process, but what Senator Levin revealed today was that before commanders at Guantanamo officially asked the Pentagon for permission to use certain kinds of harsh techniques, Jim Haynes, who at the time was the general counsel of the Pentagon, had asked some of his subordinates to go and look at how the military uses what's called survival, evasion, resistance, and escape training. This is training that's given to Air Force and Navy officers who may be captured in wars to try and help them resist very harsh techniques such as waterboarding. Mr. Haynes wanted to know whether any of those kinds of techniques would be useful to interrogate detainees captured in the so-called war on terror.
Apparently, the Bush administration civilian appointees, as you say, Jim Haynes, approached the U.S. military about what's called the SEER school. This is the place where this is taught.
That's right. I remember once talking to Richard Armitage, who was the former Deputy Secretary of State under Colin Powell, who said that he went through that training when he was a younger military officer, and he said it was one of the most difficult things he'd ever done. He described it being waterboarding. He said it was torture and should never be used on anybody.
Well, is the Senate Armed Services Committee accusing the Bush administration of any crime in this?
They're not explicitly saying the administration broke the law. What they are saying is that a lot of the legal rationale that was drafted by the Justice Department to justify some of the techniques was badly crafted legal argument at best. I think the implication is that the law may have been broken. They're not saying it so explicitly.
Well, we've already been reading, you know, criticism of parts of the report that have been leaked. You know, for instance, things we've heard before, that if we were training U.S. troops, if the U.S. military was training U.S. troops, you know, how to respond to interrogation, why would you want to then use the very same techniques that you were hoping wouldn't be used against U.S. troops? We've heard that kind of criticism, but what else might be the fallout from today's hearing?
Well, I think that one of the questions will be when we have a new president next year, whether it's a Democrat or Republican, John McCain, who's been very critical of the administration's interrogation techniques, is whether they will proceed with any kind of legal action against the civilians in the Pentagon and the Justice Department during the Bush administration who were responsible for these memos. And I think depending on what these people have written in emails, there may be possibilities of certain emails being brought out as evidence and used against them in any kind of illegal proceedings. And that's one of the readings that one of the reasons that the administration, while it says it is not using waterboarding anymore, still will not say whether they consider waterboarding to be torture, because there will be huge legal ramifications by admitting that publicly.
And we remember that last week 56 Democrats asked the Justice Department to appoint a special counsel to investigate whether the Bush administration broke laws in approving harsh techniques. Dimitri Sevastopoulos, Pentagon correspondent for the Financial Times from Washington, thank you.
You're welcome, Robin.
We want to have a conversation today about how a change in taste and technology can change the balance of nature. The bluefin tuna, weighing in at half a ton and measuring 6 feet long, was until recently considered unfit for human consumption. But these days, it's both the world's most desired fish and the world's most endangered. So frenzied is the demand for the bluefin for sushi that a single perfect specimen recently sold for $175,000 in the fish markets of Japan. That's about $395 a pound. But that same demand may be this giant fish's death knell. Some researchers estimate that the breeding stock in the Western Atlantic is only 20% of what it was in the 70s. Richard Ellis is a conservationist, biologist, and author of the article Bluefin in Peril. It was in the March issue of Scientific American magazine. His new book, Tuna, A Love Story, is due out in July, and many of us do love tuna. We may be biting into a sandwich right now. So, Richard Ellis, first make a distinction for us between the bluefin and the tuna we know in a can.
Well, they're very, very different fish. The tuna that we get in cans are basically two kinds. The white meat tuna, and it's always labeled white meat tuna, is a fish that's actually called an albacore. Mm-hmm. And they're about 3 feet long, and they're shaped very much like all the other tuna, but they're not very large, and they're not endangered. The light meat tuna is a fish called a skipjack. Yeah. It's also a tuna, but it's called skipjack, and it's about 3 feet long and very, very plentiful. They'd have to be plentiful to supply all the cans of tuna that are sold around the world. The bluefin tuna, on the other hand, is the world's champion tuna. It's the biggest, fastest, most beautiful, smartest, most highly evolved, probably the most highly evolved fish in the world.
I want to hear more about that, but there's also yellowfin and big eye tuna. But, you know, what's the difference there?
They're different species. They don't get as big as the bluefin. They are the fish, yellowfin and big eye, are the fish that are most often served in America as sushi. They are the fish that are often grilled. You do not get very much bluefin tuna in the United States.
So bluefin, you just extolled its virtues. I know it's one of the few warm-blooded fishes, but what else about it has made people so passionate about it?
Well, it depends on how you define passion. The people who are passionate about it are mostly the Japanese, and the Japanese regard the belly meat of the bluefin tuna as the most wonderful thing in the entire world to eat.
Is that recent?
Relatively recent. It only dates from the time that the Japanese were able to refrigerate fish in restaurants and in stores. This was not a Japanese custom before that. They either pickled fish or smoked it. Once they could refrigerate, and that was well after the Second World War, once they could refrigerate it, they were able to store it, and then they were able to produce it as sushi and sashimi, which has, in recent years, made them go crazy.
Well, and tell us more. I mean, obviously, suddenly it's become in favor for a taste factor, but there seems to be something else about this creature, some certain nobility to it or some difference between it and other fish.
Well, it's larger than most fish, for one thing. They actually can weigh 3/4 of a ton. They can weigh 1,500 pounds. They can be 12 feet long, more than 6 feet long. They are fast. They are powerful. They are probably, with the possible exception of swordfish, the most widely distributed large fish in the world. There are basically three types. There's the Pacific bluefin, which lives, ranges from Japan to California. There's the Southern bluefin, which hangs out around Australia and New Zealand. And then there's the North Atlantic bluefin, which is the fish we're talking about, which breeds in the Mediterranean and in the Gulf of Mexico, and it's the North Atlantic bluefin that is in such serious trouble.
Well, explain why. Why?
Well, why is unfortunately relatively easy to explain. They breed in two places, in the Gulf of Mexico and the Mediterranean. The Gulf of Mexico has a lot of ways in and ways out, if you can just imagine what it looks like. The Mediterranean, on the other hand, has only one way in and one way out. And fishermen regard that largely as a custom-made fish trap. They wait for the bluefin tuna that breed there. They wait for them to reach a certain size. Then they catch them, they fatten them in pens, and they kill them and ship them all to Japan. It can sell for several hundred dollars a meal. There's a restaurant here in New York called Masa, which has a prefix of $400 a person, and the main course is always one slab of raw tuna.
Oh.
A small slab, by the way. $400 a person here in New York. It's the most expensive restaurant in New York. It may very well be the most expensive restaurant in the world.
Huh. Well, picking up on something you just said, the fishermen who hunt for the bluefin, which, you know, they travel in packs, the bluefin, they capture them and then grow them further. I mean, explain that, because some would say there are quotas against, taking too much fish out of the sea. There are laws about bluefin.
Well, there are laws against catching too many. There are no laws against herding too many, rounding up too many. That is the loophole that the fishers in the Mediterranean were able to drive their purse seiners, their fishing boats, through, because there are no quotas. They're not killing any fish at that point. What they're doing is catching them. They catch them in a big net. They transfer them to another pen. They tow that other pen to a place that's off, another pen that's offshore, and they keep them in that other pen for 6 months, 8 months, feeding them daily until they get big enough and fat enough to kill and ship off to Japan. This happens in every single country in and around the Mediterranean. It happens in Spain, it happens in France, it happens in Tunisia, it happens in Libya, it happens in Egypt, it happens in Greece, it happens in Italy, it happens in Morocco. All these countries are fishing on the same stock of Mediterranean bluefin tuna.
How can that be? Because, you know, if the ban is on catching too many, how can they make the distinction between catching it and taking it away and farming it and raising it and catching it and killing it? I mean, it just seems like the same thing.
Ultimately, it ends up being the same thing. And they can get away with it because fisheries are very, very difficult to police. In fact, there's nobody policing this. There's an organization called ICAT, which is the International Convention for the Conservation of Atlantic Tuna. They meet every year, and they set these quotas out, at which point all the countries that I just named fish illegally and pay no attention to the quotas. Because what's going to happen? Is the Dutch Navy going to come and shoot them out of the water? They do it. It's illegal. They're making so much money at this that nobody can stop them. The World Wildlife Fund recently called for a complete closure of the Mediterranean tuna fishery. The fish are that endangered. Guess what happened? Nothing.
Well, and as you point out, the worst thing about this kind of fishing, catching all the fish when they're young, and then taking them off to a fish farm, raising them, and then killing them, is that they don't breed.
Of course not, because they catch them before they're old enough to breed. So not only are they decimating the population, they're preventing the population from replicating itself.
That's Richard Ellis, biologist, conservationist, author of the article Bluefin in Peril in a recent issue of Scientific American. When we return, a look inside the world's only successful bluefin tuna breeding facility. It's a very secret operation in Australia. Later today, a Shakespeare troupe reaches out to the homeless, but can King John resonate with a pauper? Back in a minute, here and now. We've been speaking with biologist, conservationist, and author Richard Ellis about the imperiled bluefin tuna, the world's most expensive and most endangered fish, in a recent article in Scientific American and in a new book that's due out next month. Richard says the demand for high-quality sushi, it's the belly meat of the bluefin tuna, is highly sought after in Japan. And the willingness to play for that will mean certain extinction for the bluefin unless immediate action is taken. And Richard, you know, some have said, what about tuna farming? Now, you quote Columbia University oceanographer John Mara saying fishing in the ocean is no longer sustainable. He proposes aquaculture as a solution not only for the bluefin but for other fish. But we know farm fishing has problems as well, pollution from waste products, fish getting sick and cramped in dirty pens.
Well, there are a lot of problems with it, but it has to be, as John Mara pointed out, it has to be seen as a solution, because we cannot keep taking all the fish out of the ocean and expecting them to replenish themselves. It doesn't work that way. You kill enough of a species and the species becomes extinct. That's what we're doing with tuna. We've done it with other creatures in the past. An example, of course, which has nothing to do with the ocean, is the passenger pigeon. The passenger pigeon used to be the most numerous bird in America, probably the most numerous bird in the world. We killed them all.
Well, is there any way the craving for sushi can be reduced? I mean, other foods have passed in and out of fashion.
It would be nice if everybody in Japan would say, yuck, I hate bluefin tuna, and then the market would collapse, and then the bluefin tuna could swim merrily for the rest of its existence. But it's not likely, any more than the Americans are likely to say, oh, we shouldn't be eating that much beef because, whatever the reason, nobody will have a hamburger anymore. It won't work. It's not easy to convince an entire country to stop eating something.
Well, meanwhile, research is being done into farming the bluefin tuna. You had the opportunity to visit a unique facility in Australia. It was like Fort Knox, pretty strict security. Explain.
Well, I went to South Australia last year as I was completing the tuna book, because I wanted to see up close what they were actually doing. And I'd had a certain amount of experience in Australia. I'd been there several times before. And I knew a lot of the people that were involved in this enterprise. So I went down there, and they very openly showed me their facility. They wouldn't let me take any pictures, but they showed me their facility. It's a facility that has a 790,000-gallon tank in which they were attempting to get male and female bluefin tuna to spawn. What they had done is they had replicated the conditions in which these fish spawn in the Indian Ocean, mm-hmm. north of Australia. And when I was there in March of last year, they failed. The tuna did not spawn. So they had no sperm, they had no eggs. The tuna just kept swimming around in circles. And I came back and I wrote in the book, too bad, but there's still hope that they may succeed. In March of this year, in March of 2008, they succeeded. They got the bluefin tuna to spawn. They are now raising tiny, I mean, it takes a long time to grow a 700-pound fish. Tuna are born at about the size of a grain of rice, but still they are raising them. And in this lies the potential salvation of the bluefin tuna, because if they can do this, they will be able to sell the tuna at a lower price than the Mediterranean fishers, who have to spend a fortune penning them and feeding them and everything else and chasing them, and therefore might. I mean, it's certainly not a definite thing, but they might knock the bottom out of the Mediterranean market. If the Mediterraneans can't make all that money, in other words, if the Australians can sell their tuna to the Japanese, the countries in the Mediterranean won't be able to sell their tuna to anybody. They'll go out of business. The tuna then in the Mediterranean will be left alone, and they will breed and live happily ever after.
Well, I just want to read a little bit from the end of your article. Again, you have a book coming soon, but you say, the big game fisher sees the bluefin tuna as a sleek and powerful opponent. To the harpooner, it's an iridescent shadow below the surface. To the purse seiner, that's again the fisherman that pulls up this net like a purse, sees a churning maelstrom of silver and blue bodies to be hauled on board. The longliner sees a dead fish, you know, caught in his line, pulled onto the deck with so many other marine creatures. You go on and on. The tuna rancher sees the bluefish as an anonymous creature to be force-fed until it's time to drive a spike into its brain and sell it. But you end by concluding, those who wish to rescue the tuna from biological oblivion, it now has to be seen as a domesticated animal like a sheep or a cow.
Because if we continue to fish on these fish as wild animals, we will drive them to extinction. If we can breed them the way the Australians seem to be doing, we will change our attitude towards fish like that, which is okay. I mean, I would rather that we didn't kill these wonderful animals, but people do have to eat, and fish happens to be particularly good for you. And so if we can breed them like cattle or pigs or sheep, then everybody who wants to eat this tuna meat will be able to do so, and we will not feel as if we're driving them to extinction. I mean, nobody worries about how many cows there are on the Western Plains, after all. We keep making more.
Richard Ellis, biologist and author of the upcoming book, Tuna, A Love Story. And just one last thought, Richard. Is that about what we've been talking about, the world's insatiable love of sushi? Or is it about your love?
It's about everybody loves tuna. People eat tuna fish sandwiches. They eat tuna salad. People grill tuna. The Japanese go crazy for uncooked tuna. The big game fisherman loves the tuna because it's a hard-fighting, very large fish. Me, I love it because I think it is the quintessence of life in the ocean. It's fast. It's beautiful. I actually paint these creatures, too, and I've had a wonderful time painting the bluefin tuna's portrait. It is a marvelous-looking creature. I love the bluefin tuna, so partially it's my love story, but it's also that everybody else, for very, very different reasons, also loves the bluefin tuna.
As a matter of fact, you're being humble. You're considered one of the foremost painters of marine natural history subjects. So, Richard, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us.
Thank you, Roman.
Okay, just fascinating. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, as the Midwest struggles, we're going to look back at the great Midwestern flood of 1993, at the time the most devastating deluge ever in the U.S. An Illinois man is currently serving a life sentence for his role in the floods. Did he cause a levee breach by moving some sandbags, or was he sandbagged? That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, children's books in America, including the top three of all time. That's after the news, Here and Now. More than a quarter of a million people lost their homes due to foreclosure last month. That's a 50% increase over last year, according to the foreclosure monitoring firm RealtyTrack. And homeless advocates say the mortgage crisis is creating an increase in the number of homeless people. The National Coalition for the Homeless seems to agree. They report that 60% of state and local homeless shelters they surveyed have seen a spike in people coming in. But not everyone is coming in. So a unique program in California is helping the homeless by offering them a place to park. The city of Santa Barbara is allowing people to spend the night in city parking lots. 66-year-old Barbara Harvey is using the program. She recently lost her job at a loan company where she did administrative work. She now lives in her car with her two golden retrievers. And Barbara, was the crash of the mortgage industry the reason you lost your job?
Oh, very definitely. Late October of last year, it began to slow down considerably. And by November, it had definitely really dropped off. And I just thought that, okay, it's Christmas time is coming. People aren't getting, they're not refinancing their homes at this time. They're concentrating on Christmas. And then after Christmas, of course, they've used the credit cards and they're going to apply for refinancing. But that didn't happen after Christmas. It didn't happen in January, February, or March. And by March the 15th, as a result of not having any loan packages to sign, and normally I would have had at least 10 to 15 a week, then I simply didn't have an income.
You know, I mean, it sounds like one of those things that hit you like a ton of bricks, the way it hit, you know, a lot of other people. But I can still hear people saying, but couldn't you do something else? Couldn't you move to a less expensive town where the rates are lower? You know, couldn't you move in with family? I mean, to go, you know, from your work slowing down to living in your car seems so extreme. How did that happen?
Well, it is extreme. And first of all, I did start checking out leaving the state of California and perhaps going to either Oregon or Washington, where it is less expensive to live. And I had found places that I believe I would have enjoyed living in and I would have been able to afford on my Social Security as well as a part-time income. However, I couldn't afford to move. I then realized I would just simply, for the time being, have to put everything into storage and left the condo. My daughter went to live with friends, and here I am. And it happens very quickly. People who haven't been in the situation don't realize that it all happens quickly. And I could not afford $1,500 plus probably another $1,000 for gas at that time to get to Oregon or Washington.
To get
and that's
out.
What it would have cost.
To get out of the state.
To get out of the state. And I've seen people, I've met people here since, and one lady and gentleman recently, young couple who lost their work in Arizona and are heading to Northern California because a friend of theirs has some work. They've just got a backpack on their, you know, they don't have anything else. They don't have furniture. They don't even have a car.
Well, another part of your story is that you are now taking advantage of this service that's being offered by the city, working with advocates to spend the night in your car in a parking lot. Now, we understand that the parking lot, for instance, that you're in is just for women only. What has this done for you? I mean, someone say, oh, God, a parking lot, that's awful. But it sounds as if it's been a godsend for people.
Well, it is a godsend because any one of us can be ticketed on the street if we're sleeping in our cars at night.
It's illegal in California to sleep in your car.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And not only that, is that I tried that for 3 nights and I was worried. I thought, well, even with the dogs, how do I know who's walking the streets, who's around? And it was in a reasonably good neighborhood. But I still worried. I still really didn't sleep well. And so with the safe parking, it means that I have a place to go at nighttime, and I know the people who are there. And the gate is closed. We have a key. We open it. We close it. It's a very, very peaceful place to be as well.
Well, we want to turn to Gary Linker. He's executive director of the New Beginnings Counseling Center in Santa Barbara. They're the ones who started this parking lot program so that homeless people could sleep safely in an enclosed parking lot and not have to be out on the streets. Gary, first of all, is this unique?
The only other program that we're aware of that is operational is in Eugene, Oregon. The program was actually founded by Peter Marin at the Committee for Social Justice. We took it over from Catholic Charities about 4 years ago, and we've expanded it now to where we're at 12 locations, churches, nonprofits, city and county parking lots. There are actually, last count, 187 cars that we counted about 6 months ago in the downtown corridor of people who we suspect are living in vehicles. Basically, 55 of those are now enrolled in our program at 12 different locations.
Have you seen an increase in people like Barbara, people who were fully employed and had a home and shelter just recently?
Barbara coming along is a bit unique. We have had some families who are in a similar situation, but the majority of people that we're seeing are people who were not hit by the housing crisis. These are people who have never been able to afford to buy a home. Some have rented and now are in their vehicles. Others have just been in homeless shelters and are now moving up by living in a vehicle.
Moving up? Moving up is living in a vehicle?
Yeah. We have a lot of working homeless. We have people who work for the Metropolitan Transit District. They're bus drivers. We have people who work at Vaughn's, our grocery store. We have people who work for the city and collect tickets in parking lots who are living in vehicles. And so I don't think people come here because we happen to offer this program or because we have facilities and programs for homeless people, but a number of people, for varieties of reasons, have chosen to live here in Santa Barbara and don't want to leave because of their connections here.
Well, you say there's just a handful of people who have come into the parking lots because of the foreclosure crisis, but are you feeling that changing?
Yeah, I think we're going to see some more. The housing crisis hasn't hit Santa Barbara. It's hit other communities, even in our county, because of the expense of housing here. So we are going to see, I think, some more, but it won't be the same as it will be in other communities.
Barbara, one last question to you. Again, sleeping in your car in a locked parking lot in Santa Barbara at night, getting up every morning and going to work. You have a part-time job. You make $8 an hour. You know, what do you see happening?
Well, it's going to have to change. I'm the one who has to change it.
This has been your community for a long time. You're not, you know, one of the invisible homeless. You know, you're someone people know you.
Now, suddenly, yes, and it's a bit of a surprise to me. It can be uncomfortable, but I'm getting used to it, and the dogs certainly are very obliging. They're very sweet. They get plenty of outdoor recreation, and I don't mind sharing this story because I think it's more important than my privacy. I have privacy when I need it and want it, but it's more important for people to know that they need to have a plan in case something happens with their income.
Barbara Harvey, 66-year-old mother of three who is now spending nights in a Santa Barbara parking lot, a joint venture between the city and the New Beginnings Group. Gary Linker is executive director of the New Beginnings Counseling Center. Gary, Barbara, thanks so much for speaking to us.
Thanks for having us.
Well, as always, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this or anything on the program. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. And before we go today, a history of children's literature from the Puritans to Potter. You're listening to Here and Now. If, as William Shakespeare writes in As You Like It, all the world's a stage, why not take the stage to the world? The Actors Shakespeare Project here in Boston specializes in theatrical performances in non-traditional spaces. For its most recent production, Shakespeare's King John, the company chose to perform in the basement of the Cathedral of St. Paul, a place which usually serves a large homeless population. And at one performance, the worlds of Shakespeare and the homeless came together. Here and Now's Andrea Shea has that story.
As the crowd settles down before the show, David Hurley says this isn't something he usually does.
What do I usually do? Hang in the Boston Common. I'm homeless. I was invited to come to this play, and I didn't have anything else to do, so here I am.
Hurley, who prefers his nickname Shaggy, has been homeless for 33 years. While seeing Shakespeare is new to him, the space isn't. The Cathedral of St. Paul has a large homeless congregation. Shaggy eats lunch in this room on Monday afternoons.
And I come here to watch a movie on Friday, and I go to church on Sunday in the Boston Common at 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock, and then they feed us after.
Hello, would you like a sandwich? I got peanut butter and jelly and ham and something.
Tina Rathbone is a minister for the homeless. She's the one who arranged for Shaggy's ticket for the show. The church's dean, Jep Streit, invited the theater troupe to stage King John at the cathedral.
I love the fact that this person would never get to go to a Shakespeare production under most circumstances, but he was able to go, A, because Actor Shakespeare provided the ticket for free, and B, it was in the space that he knew and was familiar to him and was safe, and so he felt encouraged to go.
Good. All right, so let's go ahead and do this first scene.
The Actors Shakespeare Project roves around Boston producing and rehearsing plays in non-traditional community spaces like this one.
This is the symbol of my kingship. Please bow. Kiss the lamp.
King John dramatizes the monarch's reign. The play is filled with greedy rulers jockeying for power. It's set in the present day as a political thriller about the arrogance of the super rich.
I see this play as a black comedy about status.
That's Bill Barclay. He plays Philip the Bastard, and he's the character the audience connects with the most. The Bastard is the witty, moral voice of the play.
Whiles I am a beggar, I will rail, and say there is no sin but to be rich. And being rich, my virtue then shall be? To say there is no vice but beggar?
During intermission, Shaggy heads outside. He lights up a hand-rolled cigarette. Then he smiles as he explains why Philip the Bastard is his favorite character.
I like the way he acts, period. He tells it like it is.
Shaggy heads back down to the basement theater. In his seat, he admits to feeling a little uncomfortable.
Nervous.
But why?
I guess because I'm with society. Because they all have a place to go after and I don't.
But still, the theater experience, he says, is helping him to get outside himself.
I happen to be in the right spot at the right time today, because here I am. So I feel lucky. I'm representing all the homeless people. Nobody else wanted to come.
And that's one of the challenges that comes with trying to connect with an itinerant, often unpredictable community like homeless people. But the Actors Shakespeare Project and the Cathedral Church of St. Paul say it's worth it to introduce even one unlikely theatergoer to the Bard.
That's Here Now's Andrea Shea reporting. For more, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Well, a quick note about some of the stories coming in the days ahead. Singularity, the debate over whether human consciousness will be able to meld with machines. Some say it's just decades away. Others call it science fiction. And is colorblind adoption always good for the child? Some African-American kids adopted by loving white parents and now grown up say no. Some stories down the road. When we come back, the Puritans banned fantasy. E.B. White had a talking spider. The history of children's literature after a minute, here and now. Determines what kids read? Well, parents may think they do, but what about publishers, editors, librarians, people who determine the books parents get to choose from? Children's book historian Leonard Marcus writes about the three centuries of these gatekeepers in his new book, Minders of Make-Believe, Idealists, Entrepreneurs, and the Shaping of American Children's Literature, and he joins us in the studio so we can have a talk about kids' books. Leonard, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
This is a very big book, and one of the themes that comes up constantly is how children's books reflect the times in which they were written. Let's start with the Puritan era. When children's books had a real purpose, what was that?
Well, it was really to prepare children for the next life, to prepare their souls. The Puritans were very gung-ho about literacy for kids, and the reason was they wanted their children to be able to read the Bible as soon as they could.
But no stories, no storytelling in that, you know, that we're used to now. No fantasy, certainly.
No fantasies for sure, because they were considered a departure from the word right. as laid down in the Bible.
When did that change, by the way, in children's books?
After the Civil War, I think, is when the floodgate of fun and fantasy to some extent opened up in American children's books. And Mark Twain was one of probably the leading writer of that kind, Tom Sawyer. Mm. There you had a bad boy who was a good boy, someone you could like even though he was full of mischief. I found that the Civil War was a turning point because prior to that, the adult world was very sure of itself morally. They created books for kids that presented an example of a good child and a bad child, and everyone was very clear about which was which. The Civil War was such a horrifying experience for the nation as a whole that I think it shook the moral certitude of America, and they became more open to looking at life in a more nuanced way, as reflected in fiction.
Tell us a little more about other times where, you know, the children's literature reflected the times.
The time of the Depression, that's when Laura Ingalls Wilder's Little House books began to appear. Right. And those are stories of pioneering life in America in the 19th century. But Americans in the 1930s were living, in a sense, in a very similar situation. They weren't on the frontier, but they were scrounging around for something to eat and to survive. And so the Little House books were embraced by Americans because they gave people hope that they too could survive in the difficult straits they found themselves in.
Another time when children's books were under the microscope, the McCarthy era, a book called The Two Reds.
Right. It was a picture book which told a very innocuous story about a boy with red hair who had a ginger cat. Those were the two Reds. But it was placed in the show windows of the FAO Schwartz toy store right on Fifth Avenue and immediately pulled by the president of the store, who was afraid that he would be painted as a communist sympathizer by displaying a book with that title. It showed you how touchy and how afraid people were at that time. And yet, very much to the librarian's credit in those days, they gave it a major prize. And when the artist did another book the following year called Finders Keepers, he won the highest prize, which is the Caldecott Medal. Yeah. And that it took a lot of courage, really, for the librarians to do that.
You mentioned librarians and the Caldecott Medal. There are people throughout history you credit with advancing children's literature. Horace Scudder, very early on, was the Atlantic Monthly editor who said America's best writers should write for children. Frederick Melcher created the Newbery and Caldecott Medals for the best in children's books. And then there was editor Ursula Nordstrom, who bravely, it seems, published these, you know, good books for bad kids. I mean, mm-hmm. It's kind of an odd genre, but tell us more about her and those books.
Over the years, children's books had been very, very sentimental and, in a sense, protective of children, afraid to venture into deep emotional waters for fear that children would be, you know, exposed to feelings that parents hoped would not emerge until later in their lives, rage, depression, sadness. But, of course, the reality is that, as Freud pointed out and others, that children have those feelings anyway, so there was no real point in keeping them out of children's books. Ursula Nordstrom, who ran the Department for Children at Harper's Publishing House, was groundbreaking in that respect. She published Harriet the Spy. She published Where the Wild Things Are.
Maurice Sendak.
That's right. She saw in him an artist who had the ability to draw children who were not perfect in the Kodak sense of, you know, beautiful blonde little children, and who had really deep feelings, which were true to the real nature of childhood.
And as he's told us, all of his children's books were based on the horror of the Holocaust and his family having part of his family dying in the Holocaust. Well, you speak of Ursula Nordstrom, but you talk much earlier in children's book history about the role of women, that very early on they had a place in children's book writing and publishing where they didn't in society. Mm-hmm. Do you think that that was restricting them to children's books, or was this giving them opportunity?
Well, it was both, really. Around the turn of the last century, around 1900, is when libraries began to offer specialized service to children and set aside children's rooms, the kind of room that we take for granted now. And in response to that new interest on the part of public libraries all over the country in children's books, publishers began to hire specialists to edit the books, which would then be sold to those libraries. And almost invariably, they hired women to fill those slots. There was an assumption, which we would call a prejudice, that women somehow understood children better than men do. And when the publishers began to hire these women specialists, the women had to really struggle within the old publishing houses to hold their own, and they suffered the insults of the men who were essentially part of a men's club. That's kind of what the culture of publishing was like in those days. But on the flip side of that was that it was the first entree of women into the professional world of publishing. And the pioneers who had those early jobs in the 1920s and 30s established what became really one of the most experimental aspects of the book world in America, and produced many classics and innovated in the creation of illustrated books and really changed the culture of childhood in America.
Hmm. Well, you obviously so love children's books. I almost hate to ask you to do this, but can you give us your top three?
I would say that certainly Goodnight Moon is one of the ultimate books of its kind. It's, mm-hmm. it's a book for babies and toddlers. It's mm-hmm. a lullaby. To me, it seems like the ideal introduction to books for very young people. For somewhat older children, but not really much older, 4 and 5 year olds, Where the Wild Things Are is also just as it should be. It's a picture book that shows children that those angry feelings that they sometimes have toward their parents are natural, at the same time that it sets out to be entertaining. I mean, it's kind of fun to see that little boy stand up to those monstrous, although also, I think, sort of goofy-looking characters that he meets on the Wild Things Island. Another book for somewhat older children is Charlotte's Web.
That's my favorite.
A book from the 50s.
Well, let me ask you about that. It's just my absolute favorite, but it breaks your heart. Mom dies.
Not everybody approved of the book in the 1950s for that very reason. Death was one of the big taboos in children's books, and Charlotte's Web was perhaps the book that helped bring that taboo down mm-hmm. in a very particular way, in that E.B. White shows that death is a part of life.
Well, let's round out your list
okay.
with books for older kids. And it also lets me ask you, you end your book with the release of the fourth Harry Potter book, Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, and the all-night, you know, Potter parties that book spawned. Of course, since then, the Harry Potter books have gotten bigger. The release of the final book was practically, you know, a national holiday. But there's also a lot of concern about, you know, where do books go from here?
I don't think those books are the be-all and end-all of children's literature. And there's so many other writers, even in the fantasy genre of our time, writers like Susan Cooper and Lloyd Alexander, and from England, Diana Wynne Jones and Terry Pratchett, and of course Philip Pullman, too. These are all writers who have very distinctive voices and different takes on imagining other worlds or other versions of our world. For kids who are inclined to reading fantasy, there are plenty of opportunities.
Leonard Marcus, his book is Minders of Make-Believe, Idealists, Entrepreneurs, and the Shaping of American Children's Literature. Thank you so much for the work and for coming in to tell us about it.
Well, thank you for having me.